This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. You're listening to a forum at Ithaca College on the private prison industry and its connection to Sodexo Marriott Services, Ithaca College's food service provider.
Let me take this opportunity to mention that after the formal program tonight, this evening, if I'm correct, there are tables set up where Kevin will be, and I'm not sure if Bob will be, but you'll have an opportunity to have some one-on-one time and to look at some of the facts and figures that he's brought along with him. Okay, thank you for your patience.
My name is Gina Genovese, and my question's for Bob Stern. You said that only 1% of your food service provides for prisons. 1% is a broad number when I don't know exactly how many prisons that could be, like that could represent. Do you have a number for that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question.
You said 1% of your food services provides for prisons. I was wondering what type of number that was, 1% of...
For Sodexo Marriott, we have no prison business. So for Sodexo Marriott Services, it's $0. Sodexo Alliance has about 1%. They're a company with somewhere around 10 billion euros, which are close to dollars. So 1% is, $100 million of sales a year.
So 1% could mean many thousands of people that are being affected by this, correct?
Yes.
Okay, that's all.
Excuse me, you wanted to say something?
Hopefully positively affected.
Hopefully. I have a specific number for you. There's approximately 3,100 people are now living in Sodexo-owned prisons around the world in Australia and Great Britain. Unfortunately, not positively affected. There was community groups had done some research on a women's prison contract that CCA lost because it was so horrible, and self-mutilation rates were 8 times higher in the women's prison than in the public prisons.
Okay, we've got 3 more people. We'll go here.
Hi, I'm Charlie, and I was wondering about the prison moratorium project. You get your funds from like these unions who will make a lot more money if the prisoners go back to public prisons, right?
Who are you directing your question to, Charlie?
Kevin.
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, the bulk of our funds come from progressive foundations. I'm on a fellowship. There's a few progressive foundations. We also have some individual donors. And it's a fair question, you know, in terms of where the funding comes from. I would mention that the funding for the representatives of Sodexo Marriott, who argue come from you, you're paying the bills for them to defend themselves around their prison connections.
All right. These unions will be more successful if the industry goes back to more public prisons, right? And like these companies who have been found in the past to be connected with organized crime and such.
Yeah, the unions are definitely concerned about it, and some of it is about, you know, who their membership is. One thing to point out, though, is, you know, current union members are not going to lose their jobs to private prison companies because private prisons are the new prisons, right? But they're concerned sort of about the profession because part of the problem is, and we know a lot of corrections officers and have relationships with them and lots of differences, but one thing that happens is once you have competition from these private prisons that cut services and cut staff, then there's more pressure on all the public employees to cut wages, to cut staff, to lessen working conditions, and so it makes the public prisons worse. It drags them down, and they're already, you know, a lot of them are pretty bad, as Michael pointed out.
I'm hearing Michael's looking up at me. Yes, Mike.
Well, I just wanted a slight offshoot to that question. I understand I'm making this point again and again, but I think it's important to not, in addition to whatever you debate or discussion you have about Marriott's Sodexo's role, to think about the issue of incarceration broadly, not to simply make it a private versus public and which is better and which is worse, but to think about why we have so much incarceration, what are the social costs of that incarceration, regardless of who provides those services. And folks should have whatever opinions you have about private firms, but I think it will be really productive to think not simply about private versus public, because it's a very good question. Do you simply, in talking about this issue, would everything be okay if there were simply public prisons took the place of private prisons, or is this a larger issue than just public versus private? Because again, a lot of the abuses Kevin's talking about, while very real, those abuses happen in spades in public prisons as well. This is not private prisons are horrible, public prisons are great. the sort of shape of the world is far more complicated than that. And don't just break it down into that pretty simple dichotomy.
Thank you. We have two more people, please.
Yes, my name is Joel Rabinowitz.
Can't hear you.
Thanks. I'm Joel Rabinowitz, and I'm a staff person at Ithaca College. I work in Alumni Hall. And my question is for Kevin. Actually, I have two related questions. First, and I need to preface this by saying, as somebody who protested when I was 20 years old, protested the Vietnam War and other issues, I do appreciate the concern and the activism. But my question is, where was the Prison Moratorium Project and where was YDS when Ithaca College was considering changing its contract with Chartwells a year ago and ultimately chose Sodexo Marriott Services? At this point, it seems as though Ithaca College would be in a very difficult position if it terminated its contract. And my related question is, if they did, or if you are recommending that, who would you recommend as an alternative food service provider that doesn't have this baggage?
That's a good question. We unfortunately, this campaign, we only discovered the connection the summer before last. We're a staff of maybe two or three people, and there's 500 Sodexo contracts, and so we just aren't able to get to everybody ahead of time. My understanding is actually that the Ithacan did some coverage of this when the college first proposed to sign with Sodexo, and they brought up these issues, and they said, there's a lot of complaints about Sodexo. There's complaints about rat dropping in the food, there's complaints about worker issues, there's complaints about private prisons. Do this concern you? And at the time, I think the administration determined that it wasn't serious enough, but it's not the case that no one had raised those issues before. I wish that this issue had come up earlier. It would be better. In terms of terminating the contract, it is not terribly difficult to terminate food service contracts. The standard policy for contracts is, either a 90 or 30-day escape clause in most of the contracts. Now, I don't know if the college has made the contract public for people. I have no idea what your contract says, but certainly if you can look at the contract and see, you can figure out what sort of the costs and benefits are. And I think the second question was what the alternatives are. Definitely, in theory, people would bring it in-house and the college could run it. Most colleges don't want to. Aramark and Compass, the truth about those companies is I wouldn't say the food is better at Compass or Aramark. I'm not going to promise people things that aren't going to happen. But Compass and Aramark are basically, there's three food service companies in the world. They're roughly the same size. They provide roughly the same services. They treat their workers kind of the same way. In every respect, they're the same, except that Aramark and Compass have no investments in private prisons, and that's an important difference for us.
Any response at the table?
And that's all correct. What I would just point out is that our major competitors do have businesses providing food service to prisons. Sodexo Marriott does not. And again, the investment we're talking about is Sodexo Alliances, and about a half of 1% is anything but food service to prisons.
Follow-up question, or you're fine?
I guess my follow-up was Compass is the owner of Chartwells, which was our previous contractor, and they're big, huge multinational as well. So I would have suspected, as Bob Stern said, that they might be doing some actual providing of food service to prisons. So where do you go?
Quickly, please.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up about food service. I think that I'm not thrilled that companies are making money off providing food to prisoners, but I think there's an important distinction here. Food is a commodity, right? People want to sell food, that's fine. We don't have principled objections to selling food, right? Even selling food to prisoners or to prisons to feed prisoners. We have objection to selling people, right? People are not commodities, food is, right? And so when people are sold across state lines by bed brokers, by private prisons, that's the problem. Getting money to feed prisoners, that's much lower down on our list.
Okay, thank you. Tell me your name.
My name is Meredith.
Meredith?
Meredith.
Hi, Meredith. Hi. We're going to go with Meredith, and then what we're officially going to do is move to the comment question part, okay? So pretty much for you, it doesn't mean anything except officially for me, we turn the page, all right? Meredith, please.
My question is directed to Mr. Panis. Earlier, you made some remarks that it was corporate policy to abuse children in Sodexo, in corporate CCA, I'm sorry. I'm just wondering, where is it stated corporately that that is their policy? Because I find it rather hard to believe that their policies would be written in that way.
They're not. They're not at all. But it's a lawsuit. It's William P. V. Corrections Corporation of America from South Carolina. And what the jury found, part of the jury's finding was that Corrections Corporation of America had engaged in a criminal conspiracy to use terror and abuse of children as a way of managing them and saving costs, right? So what the important thing the jury found was this wasn't just a few bad apples, a few bad guards, right? Michael's right, this happens in public prisons too, but the idea is that in order to save money, right, it's not just they pay staff less, they have less staff, fewer people to run the prison, and if you want to run the same juvenile facility with troubled kids and fewer people, how are you going to control those kids, right? The answer that CCA and WAC and HUD and private prison companies have found is that if you beat them enough, you can keep them under control more or less, right? And that's where it's a policy. But you're right, it's not a written policy at all. However, the jury found it to be the actual policy of the company.
Was this the policy of one prison or correction institution or several?
No, the jury found it in the case of the operation of this prison, but they found against Corrections Corporation of America as a whole, you know, that they engage in a pattern of basically criminal activity, that is, abusing children for this. And it's a pattern if you look in Louisiana, WAC and HUD, if you look in Michigan, CCA facilities, if you look in New Jersey, there's immigrants who are being beaten by CCA. You see it in CCA prisons all over the world.
Okay, the only thing that's going to make this last 25 minutes a little bit different is you're allowed to ask one question or make a comment. That has to be within a two-minute time frame, and I really have to flex here to make sure you stay within a two-minute time frame. Not that you could tell when I was flexing. And for the panelists, your responses have to be within a minute, please. So what I want to ensure is that everybody, because I see the lines are growing, gets an opportunity to talk. Okay, fair enough, everybody? We've been great so far. Go ahead.
Actually, I have two short questions.
Oh, there you go.
My name is Brett, and Mr. Stern, you mentioned that Sodexo Marriott will soon be owned by Sodexo Alliance, correct?
There's a proposal by Sodexo Alliance to acquire the rest of the shares, yes.
All right. And Sodexo Alliance does own private prisons in Australia and the U.K.?
I don't know if they actually own the prisons or they just conduct some prison management services in the UK and Australia, yes.
Kevin, do you have a response to that question?
They own the prisons.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me.
Please. Hi, Lee.
Hi, I'm Elaine Leader. I teach here, and I teach a course at Elmira Correctional Facility, which is a state prison, MEX. And my question is for Kevin Prentice, please. Having worked in prisons and knowing a lot about public prisons, I'm curious why we're focusing on private prisons when we know the abuses of the public prisons, and why is it that we're doing this?
That's a good question. Michael's been sort of referring to that. Two parts to that. One is that as Prison Moratorium Project, we don't just focus on private prisons. Actually, we're doing a lot of work to end the Rockefeller drug laws. And I'll put in a plug, which is March 27th. People should come to Albany to fight public prisons, the expansion of public prisons and the unnecessary drug laws. So this is about fighting the whole thing. But specifically, the reason private prisons are so important is not only are conditions significantly, although not, you know, totally like worse, always worse. But the other thing is private prisons make it easier and they create incentive to build more prisons even faster than the public sector. If you look like a state, this hasn't happened in New York, but a state like Oklahoma, private prisons have gone all over the map because they build the prison first and then they go to legislators and say, have anyone you want to get tough on? Anyone you want to put in prison? We got the prison. You know, you got the people, we got the prison. In other states, you have to get public approval to build a public prison, and so private prisons, you know, speed up, they accelerate prison expansion, and that's why we're so worried about private prisons specifically.
Okay. So my one other comment is, I think Ithaca College, one should know, is funding a credit-bearing project at Elmira Correctional Facility, and so we should know that we're working with inmates.
That's great.
Thank you. Please.
It's me again. I've got a comment this time. I wrote this out before, so I'm just going to read it. Okay. I think that this forum has made perfectly clear the fact that our board money is being invested in an industry that contributes to the decay of our society and reinforces all the negative aspects of the United States. Bob Stern did not deny that $3 billion in revenue are generated by Sodexo Marriott for Sodexo Alliance. This clarity presents a very distinct choice before President Williams. She can either choose to maintain the contract with Sodexo, assuring that CCA will continue to function and forcing every person who wants to eat on campus to become an investor in an industry that is racist, increasingly sexist, that targets the poor, and profits from rape, murder, and drug addiction. Or she can choose to do the right thing and assure that the Ithaca College does not contribute to this insidious prison industrial complex. There is a precedent for socially responsible decision. In the 80s, President Whelan pulled the college's investments from industries that were complicit in South African apartheid. The prison industrial complex is racist like apartheid, is classist like apartheid, and is ready to be destroyed just like apartheid. President Williams, please make a decision that our school can be proud of, a decision that will contribute to the well-being of our country and our world. Please dump Sodexo.
Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Cooper. I agree with Mr. Jacobson by pointing out the fact that we shouldn't limit the scope of our thinking to a simple dichotomy between private and public prisons. However, I think it's important to recognize that this unsustained growth, and it's important to recognize that privatization of the prison sector is a direct symptom of societal ills, of social inequality, all of these things, and that also that this unsustained growth of private prisons is exacerbating all those societal ills that make the climate to foster the growth of these unconscionable enterprises. In addition, on another point, I think it's important to recognize that there's almost a direct proportion between the money that is being siphoned off from education, particularly in New York State, into prison building. And whether it's private or public prisons, there's more impetus to incarcerate than there is to educate students. I think that's particular implications for institutions of higher learning, like Ithaca College, with 90% white enrollment, like other schools who are trying to increase their minority enrollment. So I think it's important to recognize that there are so many more men of color that are being incarcerated that are entering institutions of higher learning. And what is the impetus for making sure they're incarcerated? Because it's driven by profit. And I know there are larger societal problems that make the climate for unequal and unjust, the unjust auctioning off the right to punish your citizens. That is just unconscionable. There are other reasons that make those conditions there. However, it's important to recognize, again, I've said recognize 20 times, that privatization exacerbates those problems and is a direct symptom of our hands-off approach to what we do with our dollars. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joey Cronin, and I'm in YDS. I have a couple things that I want to talk about.
Joey,
first off,
you've got 2 minutes.
Okay, I have 2 minutes.
All right.
I'll be within that time span. All right, first, I want to say that last semester I was with a group of students that met with members from the administration and with representatives from Sodexo Marriott to talk about the relation between Sodexo Marriott and Ithaca College and the relation to private prisons. And one of the defenses that the representatives used from Sodexo Marriott, which was the most frequent one that they used, was a semantic argument that under French law, Sodexo Marriott's a subsidiary of Sodexo Alliance, but under American law, it's not. So you can't say in America that they're a subsidiary of Sodexo Alliance. But I just want to point out that this semantic line of defense is clearly falling because of the recent bid made by Sodexo Alliance to purchase the remaining 52% of Sodexo Marriott. Okay, here's a little math. It's not fuzzy. It's 48 plus 52 equals what? 100. All right, Sodexo Marriott will be owned by Sodexo Alliance, who contributes to the prison industrial complex and invests in Corrections Corporation of America and other private prison companies throughout the globe. Secondly, I want to say that I know that Bob Stern does not work with private prisons. I know that he works with Sodexo Marriott and that his primary concern is food. But it's undeniable that he's been using rhetoric to support the privatization of the prisons and the prison industrial complex. And he has rhetoric, but whenever Michael Jacobson or Kevin Prentice says anything about the horrors that go on within private prisons and the horrors of privatization of prisons, he has absolutely nothing specific to say about what's better about private prisons. He says that the conditions maybe have gotten better in private
seconds.
Prisons where prisons have been privatized, but there's nothing specific that he says, and it's all empty rhetoric. And as students who were forced to purchase a meal plan from Sodexo Marriott, who did, and that money does go to Sexual Alliance, I don't want to have any money go to Corrections Corporation of America when all they can use to defend themselves is empty rhetoric saying that the privatization of prisons is beneficial to prisoners, and it's clearly not true because there's no concrete evidence that he's giving, just empty promises and empty rhetoric.
Thank you. Please.
My name is Bruce King. I have a terrible fear of public speaking, so please bear with me. But I kind of want to offer a capitalist point of view on exactly what is going on here. And I do not consider myself a socialist, you know, as you know much of YDS is standing here, but I do support their opinion. Because quite simply, I guess I'll just read it because I'm getting really nervous. So the problem that I'm having is that governments are organizations which depend, or at least our government, supposedly, on the voters. They have to go back to the voters. They have to be held accountable for their positions. The problem, oh boy, I'm getting really nervous.
That's okay, go ahead. Just read your text, you'll be okay.
With capitalist systems, we have a whole new setup. The way that society is set up right now is that our money goes into markets, and that's how we represent our ideas. The problem is, the way our school administration has it set up, we are not allowed to make that voice. So if we don't agree with the money that's going to the lobbyists who are representing the three strikes and your outlaws, if we don't agree with what the corporations are doing, we are not given the choice to speak out using our dollar, because the school requires meal plans for those on campus. We are not given those options otherwise. So as a capitalist, I'd just like to say, this is bad capitalism. Our country has created, you know, antitrust laws against us. And if we're not allowing this to go on in our markets, why are we allowing it to go on our campus?
Thank you. Well said. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Mike. I'm in YDS, and I'm also in the Environmental Society on campus. At first, I was going to talk about ethics, but Michael Jacobson and Kevin Pranis basically summed up what I wanted to say, so I'm not going to repeat it. But what I am going to mention is that the way we should be looking at this is that it seems to be ignored a little bit right now. We shouldn't be necessarily looking at, oh, private prisons are so much worse than public prisons, because ethically we have to look at what is going on with the privatization, that we shouldn't even be looking at what's going on in these prisons. The bottom line for this ethically is that we should be saying what is wrong with the privatization of prison, and there's obviously something wrong if we're giving money to crime, and that we're fueling this, and we're letting, and that we're fueling this institution that in turn kind of hurts society. My second point is going to be a little bit of a beating chest thing here, rallying the troops. But Bob Stern said that if Ithaca College pulls out, that won't affect anything. That's bull, as far as I'm concerned, because there are so many campuses right now that are waiting for Ithaca College right now to say something about it. And if we say something about it now, we're going, this is a message, and that we are going to be doing something if we pull out of this. And that's the truth of the situation. So, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Lucas. You're going to have to bear with me. I have a cold. I just wanted to have a few points, and I will go into the two-minute limit. One is that there are pamphlets available about Sodexo Marriott's labor record. They will be at our table in front. It's a pretty clear indictment of their pretty poor labor record across the board, so you might want to check these out. It's put out by the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. Another thing is that we have videos that are available for people who want to watch them about, it was aired last week on Court TV about private prisons. It's called Profits of Punishment, and we're making multiple copies, so if you want to get your hands on that, show it to people, show it to your organization, contact us again at the table. The question that a gentleman raised earlier about, you know, where was YDS, where were people when we were changing the contract to Sodexo Marriott, as far as I know, I think people at Ithaca College were kind of misled by some campus administrators who, there were students who actually did kind of ask the question, you know, well, what is the deal with Sodexo Marriott and these private prisons at the very outset when they were negotiating for the contract? And we were misled into believing that, oh no, Sodexo Marriott and Sodexo Alliance has already divested all its from the private prison industry. This clearly wasn't true. I don't know how this information was given to certain administrators, but it wasn't true. So that kind of answers some of the question that someone had brought up earlier. I would have liked to have this campaign be something that was preemptive instead, obviously. Another thing about the different alternatives, for instance, Cornell does not subcontract their food service provider. There are other alternatives in terms of having it being something that's operated through the school or locally or whatnot. And lastly, I just want to say that this forum, not only is it like empowering students, and I mean, it's been a PR nightmare for Sodexo Marriott, but I would hope that this would also launch some other issues. Like, we really need to evaluate the contracts that we have, that Sodexo Marriott has with their workers on campus. Are they getting fair benefits as subcontracted laborers? Are they getting the same kind of pension plan that the workers at Ithaca College are getting? These are things we need to investigate. We need to work with the workers and make sure that they're getting their fair share.
30 seconds.
And lastly also, I mean, we could be looking at things like, you know, our apparel. This is a campaign that students have launched all across the country, getting the schools to sign on to codes of conduct to make sure that the clothes that bear the logo of the school are not made in sweatshop conditions. So I hope that we can use this forum and this momentum that students have built to kind of look at other issues that do affect us directly, because I think we can really make some tremendous strides and have this school really represent the values that we would hope it would and not be contributing to, you know, sweatshops and private prisons and things like that. So I want to commend people for showing up today, because I don't think the school really wanted you to be here based on the flyers they made out and things like that. They were pretty
Thank
wonderful.
You. Over here.
You're going to get a chance to summarize if you have it. We'll give each of you 3 minutes to do that, and then at that time I'll introduce President Williams. Thanks, Mike. We'll start from left and move over to right.
Just very briefly in conclusion, thank you again for this opportunity. I hope I tried to speak to the facts, and I hope it's helped explain some things that are not clear all the time. Sodexo Marriott is made up of our employees. That's what our company is. We have 100,000 employees. And I think people feel very proud, as I do, to work for this company. We come to work every day trying to improve the lives of people in some small way, even if it's just a better meal or a better, cleaner environment to work in. We've got a tremendous amount of good programs to train, promote people, community outreach programs to hire mentally and physically handicapped, economically disadvantaged people. And we do a tremendous amount of work, and thousands and thousands and thousands of our employees work to stop hunger every day. And it's a company we all feel very proud of working for. Thank you.
This is an incredibly important issue you're grappling with, as is the whole debate about public versus private prisons. No one, however, should be surprised about the advent of or amount of private prisons that exist. They exist because of publicly made policy. They didn't just burst on the scene for no reason. They burst on the scene because your public representatives, and I use you in the sort of larger context, not just as New York representatives, decided that criminal justice policy should be made up primarily in terms of incarceration, of longer sentences, mandatory sentences, two strikes laws, three strikes laws, abolishing parole, reduced release rates. In that environment, you cannot build prisons fast enough, whether they're public or private. And that environment leans toward the creation of something to fill that hole. If it wasn't private prisons, it would be more shabbily run or overcrowded public prisons. Difficult to talk about this issue without going back again to larger public policy making about corrections and issues such as mandatory sentencing, abolishing parole. It may seem a bit removed from the sort of public-private debate and certainly from the details about Marriott, but you have to take on those issues or your examination of specific private corrections will not get you any long-term changes, because that is the public policy made by your elected representatives. That policy was created the opening for private prisons to come in, which allows even further incarceration. But they're not appearing out of nowhere. They're appearing based on legislation that's done by folks that you and your fellow citizens elect.
Thank you.
I appreciate the chance to be here tonight.
In terms of what you've heard from Sodexo Marriott, I think that there's a couple. I think that the argument that Sodexo Marriott's barely connected, and I would point out here that if our literature, if we bought shares, I'm not sure our literature would be displayed in Sodexo Marriott offices as Sodexo Alliance's literature is, but apart from that, that private prisons are okay, even better than public prisons, that prisons are just a business like any other business, could be good or bad, right? And most importantly, that you as students can't make any difference, that whatever you do at Ithaca College can't possibly affect the private prison industry, right? That's what you're hearing, right? What can you do as students? The reason this is important now, we have to fight the drug laws, we have to fight public prisons, we have to change a lot of this stuff, but one thing you can do as students where you have power right now is changing your food service contract right here, right? And that's why a lot of times they'll suggest everything else. Sodexo Marriott will say, well, you should really be working on legislation. Yeah, we're working on legislation, right? Let's work on Sodexo Marriott and Sodexo Alliance as well, right? What have you done here at Ithaca College? Ithaca had the protest that was heard around the world. I don't know if you guys understand this, but what happened here, like I heard, you know, like TV, you know, news people calling up, hundreds of emails, people in support, you know, family, Patricia Bowman, who's the mother of Anthony Bowman, who died, who got a CCA death sentence, you know, thanks students for doing this stuff. We've heard from all sorts of people about what Ithaca College did. I want to read from you, include what Sodexo Marriott claims that you did. This is from the Montclairian, the Montclair State University paper. It's Leslie Un, who's the spokesperson. Quote, Ithaca called it a student protest, which we know isn't true, said Un. Prison Moratorium Project bussed in activists who were picketing while pulling carts and suitcases for the protest. What they're saying to the world is, students don't care about this. Only professional activists care about this. And they're telling students there's nothing you can do about it. But we've already done a lot. Everyone's watching Ithaca. This is a difficult decision, right? It's difficult because you've got to think of workers, and not all the workers make the same salaries as the general counsel. Their lives depend on these jobs, so they need to stay here, right? But I think that, I hope that you will agree with me that Sodexo Marriott needs to go unless Sodexo Alliance stops doing business with prisons. I think the message is going out from Ithaca College that you do business with students or you do business with private prisons, but you don't do both. I want to thank everyone who put this together and came. Representative Sodexo Marriott, it's not easy to sit here in front of a lot of hostile people and take these questions. I appreciate the willingness to do that, and also the administration, because, again, this is not easy. This is a big pain to deal with these kind of issues, right, and have to renegotiate this stuff. So I thank everyone who's here. Good job.
President Williams, please.
I will be brief. We've been sitting here for a long time giving good attention to this dialogue, and I just really want to do a couple things. David, I want to thank you. Where'd you go? For being moderator. And I also want to thank our panelists, Kevin Prentice, Michael Jacobson, and Bob Stern, for being with us here this evening. And I want to thank all of you who came and participated in this forum. As was mentioned earlier by David, there will be some materials out in the lobby available from various sources, so I just encourage you to stop by and take a look. As agreed, the college will announce its decision in response to YDS demands on or before March 19th. And I just want to assure you that information from this forum will be helpful to us as we deliberate over the next 4 to 5 weeks. So again, thank you all for coming. Thank you for behaving respectfully and civilly with one another. And thank you again, panelists, for spending this time with us. Good evening.
You've been listening to a forum on the private prison industry and its connection to Sodexo Marriott Services, a food service contractor for more than 400 colleges in North America. The forum took place at Ithaca College, where students have demanded that Sodexo's contract be canceled due to its parent corporation's involvement with for-profit prisons. Panelists in the preceding forum touched upon a key issue relating to private prisons. Their existence is at odds with a desire to eliminate crime. Those who profit by prisons will wish for an increase in crime as it increases their revenue. And practically, this means they will push for the creation of new crimes which warrant imprisonment in order to stay in business. Looked at this way, the negative effects are easy to see. But the issue of privatization has a deeper philosophical implication that is generally not discussed among the punditry. The notion of public ownership is based on the assumption that everyone in the society has a human right to survive, to live, and to make use of the resources of the nation to do so. By privatizing every facet of survival, the ability to pay becomes a dividing line between life and death. To me, this mechanism is no different than a mob protection racket. This gangster mentality of corporate capitalism can be seen in the article I'm about to read from the Canadian paper The National Post. It was written by commentator Murray Dobbin and published in the financial section on February 8th. It's titled Counterpoint: Water, Right or Commodity? Water, that most common of elements, the thing of life itself, is rapidly being drawn into the madness and ruin that is corporate globalization. Water, its very definition, who controls it, who will die because they can't afford it, will be the most divisive issue of this century. It will be a fight over definitions. Is water a right or a commodity? Though Canadians have rarely spoken of water as a right, it is clear that they have always treated it as such. The Canadian government, faced with its own water crisis over a NAFTA challenge regarding bulk exports, has nonetheless apparently come down on the side of commodification. Canadian officials have been quoted as seeing water as nothing more than a need that can be met by the market. Mike Harris is already preparing the ground for a massive redefinition of the relationship between water and human beings. Canada's preeminent anti-government leader has stated unequivocally that the private sector will play a key role in future water services in Ontario. But messing with the means of life may just attract the kind of massive public opposition that the corporate globalizers want to avoid. Two cases involving third world communities demonstrate what is coming down the road. The most famous example to date involves the people of the town of Cochabamba, Bolivia. Its citizens launched a successful popular uprising explicitly against that trio of institutions: the World Bank, a huge transnational corporation, in this instance Bechtel Corporation, and the state, that virtually define corporate globalization. In February 1999, the World Bank told the mayor of Cochabamba that if the city did not privatize its water system, it would not receive another cent of financial assistance for local water development. Then, after judging the resulting Misiuni privatization project financially unviable, the bank proceeded to back it anyway, insisting on water pricing that would cover the excessive costs and guarantee that Bechtel would earn a 16% profit. Water prices for many locals tripled, meaning some people were paying 20% of their income for water. In a scenario impossible to parody, people not even hooked up to the system were told they would have to put meters on their private wells and pay Bechtel for the water they drew. The resulting citizens' revolt shook the Bolivian government. It led to a week of protests, general strikes, and highway blockages, which brought major areas of the country to a virtual standstill. The government caved and told Bechtel to leave. The privatization was reversed, and the water system handed over to the town. But Bechtel had not given up. Apparently anticipating trouble, Bechtel made moves before its expulsion that guaranteed it access to one of the world's 1,500 powerful bilateral investment treaties. These treaties, mini-MAIs with all the intrusive power of the failed multilateral agreement on investment, allow corporations to sue governments directly. And Bechtel, knowing that Bolivia had such an agreement with Holland, transferred its holding company from the Cayman Islands to Holland. It is now using the BIT to sue Bolivia for $40 million. The second case involves the Mexican town of Guadalcazar. Faced with plans by an American corporation, Metalclad, to take over a toxic waste site and build a toxic waste treatment facility, the people of the town refused. They had once driven the previous owners out of town with machetes for polluting their water supply. This time, they simply refused to grant a construction permit to Metalclad. The planned facility was never built. But the decision of the townspeople has now been turned into a major NAFTA challenge. Metalclad sued Mexico under the notorious Chapter 11 of NAFTA and was awarded $16.7 million, based on the town's actions. The ruling by the tribunal is a cautionary tale for Canadian municipalities, and I might add American ones as well. The tribunal ruled that NAFTA applies without qualification to subnational governments, and that the environmental impact considerations, public opinion, and the past performance record of the proponent were matters outside the jurisdiction of local government. It also found Mexico liable for the uncertainty Metalclad claimed to have about the approvals it needed from other levels of government, and its award included costs incurred before Metalclad had even applied for local approvals. What makes the case especially interesting is that Mexico is appealing the decision, using a Canadian judge as arbiter. Will the judge take his direction from the extremely narrow rules of NAFTA's Chapter 11? Or will he take into account the public interest that would be considered if such a case was before a Canadian court? The case will be heard in Vancouver beginning February 19th. The federal government has been given intervener status. On whose behalf will they intervene? Will they defend Canadian municipalities from a NAFTA chapter Canada now wants to renegotiate? Or will they defend the right of Metalclad to run roughshod over democratic government? And that was by Murray Dobbin, Counterpoint, Water, Right, or Commodity, from the February 8th edition of the Canadian National Post. On February 20th, three Canadians will visit Ithaca to warn of the possible consequences of the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, which could expand NAFTA-like trade rules to the whole of the Western Hemisphere. In April, 34 heads of state will be meeting in Quebec City with the goal of creating a free trade zone that will extend from one end of the Americas to the other. The text of the new trade rules has not yet been released, and the meetings are not open to public scrutiny. The purpose of the Canadians' visit is to call attention to the upcoming summit, to educate the public about the possible consequences of an expanded free trade agreement, and to demand openness in the negotiating process. The visitors will be Helen Valliere from the Summit of the Americas Welcoming Committee, CASA, in Quebec, and Sarita Ahuja and Jaggi Singh from the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, CLAC, in Montreal. They will meet with Ithaca College students at noon in Textor 102, with Cornell students from 4 to 5:30 at a place to be arranged, and with the general public at Southside Community Center from 6 to 9 p.m. Everyone is invited from 6 to 7 p.m. to mingle over refreshments, and the actual program will begin at 7 p.m., with a presentation from the visitors and local community organizers, followed by an open discussion. The downtown event is sponsored by the Ithaca Coalition for Global Justice, which meets every Monday from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Southside Community Center. The Southside Community Center is located at 305 South Plain Street in Ithaca. For more information, contact Jesse Lind at area code 607-273-0532, or write to Jesse Lind, J-E-S-S-I-E-L-I-N-D, at hotmail.com, or just send a message to unwelcome guests, unwelcome@radioforall.net. To close, we'll look at the result of neoliberal policies as Rob Callahan from KVSC Radio interviews Chuck Collins, author of Economic Apartheid in America.
Chuck, I'd like to start with economic apartheid in America. Why the term economic apartheid? Does it really apply? Is our social stratification that bad that it's comparable to apartheid?
I think we're drifting toward an apartheid, and it's probably more subtle in that we think we've had an economic boom when in fact it's a very uneven economic boom, and the trends that we see are, you know, rising prison construction, gated residential communities, a sense of social polarization, a division within communities and between communities that really is very different than 30 years ago. So I think we're drifting toward a much more polarized apartheid society.
And you've been working with United for a Fair Economy. Just for the listeners, can you tell me a little bit about what you do there?
Yeah, we're a national organization that was formed 6 years ago to draw attention to the dangers of growing income and wealth inequality. We do education programs for schools and religious congregations and business and labor groups. We do some advocacy on public policies that would lessen inequality. And we do some research and reports related to those themes. And we're trying to help people who are concerned about this issue find each other and work together to make the economy work for everybody.
Has it been working very well for you?
Yeah, it's been, I think we've come in a very short 5 years, we've come a long way. I think that the recognition of the income gap is much greater. I think there's still a lot of work to do for us to understand the whole dimension of the wealth and savings gap. I think one of the things that will happen is if there is an economic recession, some of these inequality trends, I think, are masked by the fact that people are working longer hours and putting more and more basic expenses on credit. And when there's a downturn, all of a sudden the sort of mask will be pulled off and we will find that the new economy has a real downside and it's related to this pulling apart.
Now, as far as the wealth and savings gaps go, how are those laid out?
Well, one way it plays out is at the very top end. The richest 1% of households now has about 42% of all the private wealth, which is double the share they had about 25 years ago. So more wealth is concentrated in fewer hands. And in a democracy, that's a problem because concentrated wealth is concentrated political power, the power to write the rules and shape the culture of our society. And how it plays out for people, say, in the middle or lower and middle income people is less savings, less retirement security. The wealth gap means that we're seeing a declining savings and standard of living for people in the middle. So people who used to be in the middle had more per capita savings and more opportunities in terms of purchasing a home and that sort of thing. We're starting to see those opportunities diminish for a growing number of people.
Now, proportionally, have the different classes, we'll say the working class, the middle class, and upper class, have they proportionately stayed about the same size? Has the mean income, for example, still stayed with roughly the same number of Americans or the same percentage of Americans, or is that changing?
Well, you know, if we take what's interesting to look at is in the 30 years after World War II, every fifth, from the lowest income fifth to the highest income fifth, saw their incomes double over those 30 years, you know, from 1947 to 1977. In the 25 years, in the last 25 years, the richest top, you know, 10% has pulled away, seen their income double. The bottom 40% has actually seen their real incomes, taking out inflation, decline, people moving backwards. And the middle has stood still. And that's the last 4 years, the middle class has finally gotten back to the starting line in terms of real income, real weekly wages that during the 80s and early 90s, real wages plummeted. So even after a 10-year economic boom, the household in the middle is just trying to get back to the starting line when Richard Nixon was president.
I'm reading over a summary of economic apartheid in America that mentions the government and corporate rule changes that have favored the wealthy and excluded the poor over the year. Could you give me some details on exactly how this has been done and how can it be changed?
Well, this kind of gets to the root of the question of how did this happen? You know, and some people would say, well, technological change, or, you know, this is just sort of like the laws of nature. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. And our analysis is that growing inequality in America is the result of a shift in power that on the one hand, the power of global corporations and wealthy donors has increased. The power of communities and workers and consumers has sort of decreased. And as a result of that, the rules that govern the economy, tax policy, global trade policy, Federal Reserve policy, what Alan Greenspan does, all those rules have been very good to asset owners, substantial wealth holders, and not particularly good for people who work for wages. So the rules have been tilted in the last two decades in a way that has put at risk the standard of living for the vast majority of people. But it's also good news, which is the rules can be changed to make the economy work for everybody. We can raise the minimum wage. We can have a tax policy that's fair to working families, not just favoring the wealthy. You know, these things are in our control. We just need to have the political will and the sort of informed citizenry to ensure that, that's possible.
And I'd imagine the patience to see the process through.
Yeah, but it you know, if you think, boy, these trends, these shifts, the shift in wealth has happened in two decades. There's no reason why we couldn't, as a society, say we think growing polarization is a dangerous direction for us as a democracy. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for civic life. Let's place a higher value on not being so polarized as a society. Let's do what we did after World War II. Let's expand home ownership, expand savings, give a generation of people a debt-free college education. All those would be very good investments in a society that shares prosperity and has real equality of opportunity.
Now, in the book, you've called for a broad social movement to prevent or combat economic apartheid. And I'm wondering how you see things like the WTO and IMF protests in sort of perspectives of a broad social movement of this kind.
Well, I think that you know, the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle and the protests around that were a good example of a rumbling in the land. I think that this emerging social movement is happening. It's you can see it in the student movement, students saying we don't want our clothing made in sweatshops. You can see it in the religious communities where people are saying we need to have a moral discussion about the economy. This is not, you know, how much growth there is and how much riches there are for the rich is not the moral measure of an economy. The moral measure of an economy is how the least of us are doing. And so there's this organized rumbling, and the Seattle protests and the street protests are the most visible sort of eruption of that. But there's a lot of other less visible sort of below the radar screen work that's going on that I think is leading to will lead to some fundamental changes in the coming decade. One way to think about it is I think we should be preparing for an economic downturn, and that is an opportunity to talk about what kind of economy and what kind of society we should have, and work to make, you know, our elected officials accountable to everybody, not just the donors who give them the big contributions.
This goes back to, again, the synopsis of economic apartheid that I'm looking at. The statement was made in it that the religious, neighborhood, cultural, and political threads that held communities together are beginning to fray with family workers or family members working longer hours. How is that happening?
Well, what's happening is that in order to maintain a standard of living, people are working two jobs, or more people in a household are working two and three income earners, you know, supporting a household, whereas, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, one paycheck was enough to have a decent life. And what that means is that people have less free time. They have less free time to spend caring for children or elders or participating in civic life. And that sort of backfires on having a healthy society. If people are working so much, they just don't have slack to go to a civic meeting, to participate in a religious congregation, to care for the elderly neighbor who maybe needs their sidewalk shoveled or whatever. And that, I think, leads to a sort of fragmentation and a sense that, oh, you know, that we're on our own. We're all just individuals out there like asteroids circling in the outer space, and That's a myth. You know, we're really fundamentally interconnected, and one inaction on the part of some hurts other people. And that's, we need to go back to remembering the core values of this country and what it is that we should, that's important. And this new economy has a certain set of values and a culture that I think is very alien, really, to people. It's just, you know, let's get as much money, take the money and run. Let's accumulate as much as we can today, and let's not think about the consequences for anyone else. And that's not a healthy culture.
I'd imagine that the people who most benefit from the status quo have really enjoyed this process.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that many of the beneficiaries are starting to speak out about the dangers of growing inequality. We started a project called Responsible Wealth that has 450 business leaders, people who are in the richest 5%, who are saying, you know, this is not the kind of society I want to live in or that I want my children to grow up in. I don't want to live in an apartheid society. And that ultimately, these economic trends are bad for everybody, even the people we think would benefit them from them. And an interesting thing we're involved with is, you know, the Congress and the Bush administration are going to try to repeal the estate tax in the next couple months, the tax on the very wealthy inheritances. And we have put together a very interesting group of people who you will not expect to have heard speak out on this issue. And in the next couple of weeks, you'll be hearing from them. And it'll raise a lot of eyebrows. But you're going to hear from some of the wealthiest and prominent families in this country speaking out about against the repeal of the estate tax.
What else is in the future for United for a Fair Economy?
Well, I think that we're going to be very involved in making sure that the new administration doesn't push through policies that will worsen inequality in America. We're concerned about President Bush's proclivity to give tax cuts to the rich, school vouchers, things like that. We're also keeping an eye on the global front. There's a new treaty, the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, which is being negotiated now. It's essentially NAFTA for the whole hemisphere. And in Quebec in April, there will be a summit meeting of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We hope to have tens of thousands of people there to basically protest and say that treaty should not worsen standards. It should lift standards. So, and if people are interested, if it's okay, I'll give a web address, which is www.ufenet.org. It's a website, ufenet.org, that has information on these different things. Or if you don't have website, you can call. We have a toll-free number, which is 877-JOIN-UFE. And we can send out an information packet on how people can be involved in working on these concerns.
That was Rob Callahan speaking with Chuck Collins, author of Economic Apartheid in America.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.